It's good to be back. Hello, gang. How are we all? Welcome to another special edition of the Winners Club. This is a very special edition, by the way, guys. We have got the one and only Rob Flaherty in the building. Well, he's not in the building, but you get the point. He's here. Rob is the chairman of Ketchum, one of the biggest brand marketing agencies on the planet, and we'll be talking all about managing a brand reputation. Welcome to the show. Very much looking forward to this fireside conversation with Rob. So hello, my friends. How the devil are you? Hope all is good in the proverbial hood. Can you guys give me a flash of your mics if you're on the stage, if you can hear me properly and correctly? I just want to double check. Yes, okay, cool. We're all good. We've got a new setup. The Winners Club has now got multiple locations. We've got studios in Ilford. We've got studios in Chislehurst. If we get really desperate, we're going to give Ash a mixing desk and a microphone, but God forbid that ever actually happens. So thanks for tuning in, guys. Very excited about this. We had hugely, hugely positive feedback about this conversation last week. We've got the one and only Rob Flaherty, who is going to be joining us in about 5-10 minutes time. Now, Rob is the chairman, as I mentioned in the intro, of Ketchum, which is one of the biggest marketing agencies on the planet. And Rob is people at the top of their game. Rob is like the 0.00001% of people that big brands basically call in when they have got stuff that is happening. So when, you know, the companies that make your mobile phones and your big social media followings and the people who make your trainers and the restaurants you go to, when those brands and businesses are deciding the direction that they're going to take with their branding, marketing, PR, communications, Rob and his team at Ketchum are the people that they call in. Rob's got 40 years worth of experience, and what this guy doesn't know about branding and marketing, frankly, isn't worth knowing. So it's going to be very, very exciting. As I say, we had a session one last week with Rob, which was great. And today we're talking all about managing brand reputation, specifically what's happening on the coalface. Is there actual big action being taken by brands and businesses, or is it useless virtue signaling? How do you spot the difference between the two? What are the difficulties with this, etc.? So I'm very excited. We're going to have the fantastic David Gallagher, who is going to be curating the conversation with Rob alongside our good friend John O'Brien when he jumps into the room today. Rob is in the building. Rob, how are you, my friend? Are you there?
Here, yes.
He is. Hello, Rob. How are you?
Great. Good to be with you.
We are very delighted to have you. Thank you for being here again, my friend. We've just done a bit of a quick intro. I will be, myself and Ash and Paul will be in the background sort of making sure that the room runs correctly. But if it's all right, John, I'd like to hand over to you, if I may, my friend, for you to take over, you and David to take over the conversation, curate the conversation, fireside with Rob, and then we'll open it up a little while later to some audience and panel Q&A, if that suits you guys.
Thank you, James. Thanks, everybody. And Rob, thank you for coming back again. We've just been talking in typical British fashion weather. David has said there's a little fire at his home there. I have to say, I'm looking at it very wet and very miserable, and I'm trying not to be wet and miserable myself. So, Rob, I don't know what it's like with you, but welcome, and it's great to have you in here. last week we had, you know, rip-roaring conversation. I know that many of the people that are in the audience and on the stage will have come back for more, and I'm sure that we can build on this. But, we were talking, to get straight into it, we were talking about the sort of reputation opportunities, this new decade being termed the Roaring Twenties. I don't know if, there's been much difference than this, but one of the things that I know that I wanted to pick up on was really seeing how the way in which, you know, you said that companies taking action that are about addressing either social justice or, let's say, environmental sustainability issues, those things which are now coming in to almost push or encourage the brands into new areas of brand-related marketing. I wondered if you could give us a little bit more insight into what you're seeing in that space, and then we can talk a little bit more about the risks and opportunities, perhaps, Rob. Over to you.
Sure. Thank you, John, and all. Last week, to kind of roll back the tape a little bit, I talked about the Roaring Twenties through two different lenses. One is that we can anticipate the economy will be roaring very soon with 7% GDP growth and loaded with marketing opportunity, right? But it will also be roaring as people really reflect on the disparities that were laid bare by the pandemic, the haves and have-nots, the disadvantages of people of color with access to healthcare. And I think we have to keep that in mind as we talk today about this. I think we've seen a lot of really good things, both in social justice, racial justice, environmental sustainability, over the past year and a half, as companies have made genuine efforts. Let's talk for a moment just about the efforts inside the company. We have now more recruiting of people of color, more hiring, actual programming around diversity, equity, inclusion, good mentoring programs, employee resource groups, being advanced to leadership roles. On the environmental side, genuine efforts to get carbon neutrality in place and to reduce the effects on climate change. Those are all great, and I applaud all of the ones that are real. But I think that we have to be very careful now as that moves externally. Is it performative virtue signaling, or is it genuine action? Because the only thing that's going to really be sustainable as a brand is something that's backed by real action.
Yeah, I mean, that's an incredibly important thing when we talk about this sort of stuff, in that it can never be peripheral. And I do wonder, actually, obviously, some people may well simply want to jump on a bandwagon or feel that they have to do things, whereas actually others have a genuine desire to use their influence as a business to actually create not only change in society, but also hopefully enhance their performance. Because we all know that actually more diverse teams create more innovation in terms of products and services, tend to create greater loyalty in terms of employee bases, attract the best people, et cetera, et cetera. So on the people issues, obviously we would hope that people see this now as very much aligned to long-term sustainable success in business rather than just, oh, well, we have to do this because society is demanding it of us. And on the other key aspect around the environmental agenda and the sustainability credentials, that also needs to be an imperative around business performance and reducing costs and creating new solutions for today's and tomorrow's problems. So, Rob, do you feel optimistic that actually these two co-aligned forces are actually getting more accepted as core aspects of longer-term business success, as opposed to, let's say, peripheral CSR programs? I mean, do you think they're being brought into the center of business leadership now in a different way than was perhaps a decade ago?
Yes, and it's not just for the good reason that it's the right thing to do. I wish it was only for that reason. Look, there's a lot of pressure on boards at the board level to do ESG well. Environment, social, and governance. And there's real accountability behind it now. So show me your rigorous environmental program, sustainability program. Show me your social program. Show me how you are really creating greater diversity. And in governance, transparency, ethical behavior, but also diversity of your board under the governance heading. And that real pressure coming from the top now, not just the bottom, is leading to a lot of really strong programming. We're at Ketchum involved in a lot of that. Someone smart client asked me, Rob, is this a freight train or a pendulum? Meaning, are these issues going to keep coming at us so remarkably fast like a freight train? Or will the pendulum swing back and there'll be less pressure on companies to respond to these social and racial justice, environmental issues? And of course, the answer is both. It is going to continue as a freight train. There is always a pendulum effect where things wax and wane, but this is going to primarily be a freight train for quite a while. And I think that what I'm concerned about and want to issue as kind of a cautionary note is now that brands are really seeing some of these audiences that they had been flying over, they see it as great opportunity. I'm involved in conversations where the brands see it as a great opportunity, a revenue opportunity. And of course, they see it as a responsibility. So now you see suddenly every couple getting married in a TV ad is a mixed race couple. You're seeing a lot of people of color in marketing, but it feels a little bit like we have to do this. We're kind of pasting people into this otherwise very mainstream setting. And I think we have to be careful. As you mentioned, we have to make sure that the teams putting this together are diverse teams. Start from the inside. The brand team needs to be genuinely diverse. And I mean race, gender, and age diverse. And the agency teams have to be very diverse. And in order for it to be culturally appropriate, really appealing to the interests of people of color, not just kind of inserting them into an otherwise very kind of mainstream, marketing campaign. It also requires, I think, an investment in the communities. If you are going to market to these communities, you really have to also figure out genuine ways where you're investing in that community, or it's going to ring hollow. Hire minority-owned agencies to do this part of the marketing, but also make the marketing. I like it when marketing is a service. It's not just push. It is actually functioning as a service to everyone that you are, quote unquote, targeting. You're bringing them value. And that's not just the value of your product or your service. It's value in many other ways. You're providing them with a platform. You are utilizing people from their community in the marketing, sales, and distribution of your product or service. You're making the way you market your product of benefit to the community. It raises money for community centers, for example. What are some of the ways you can kind of flip this around and make it marketing as a service and as an investment in the community to make that community stronger and have more opportunity, not just take advantage of your opportunity?
Yeah, and actually, of course, we know that both in the States and in Europe, many of the inner cities and communities that have a high proportion of ethnic minority individuals are effectively underserved markets. So it's right. Extremely difficult sometimes for people to access services such as banking and things of that kind. And also, products, et cetera, just aren't marketed, or retail operations aren't based in those areas for whatever historic reasons. So I do like, what you're saying there, Rob, is that it's got to go beyond effectively just the fact that every TV advert is now multiracial or anything of that kind, not least because that, of course, can also fuel a backlash.
That's right.
So this needs to go, deep into the approach and deep into the rationale behind any such marketing campaigns, et cetera. I mean, do you think we're all associated, frankly, in the top row, look at us, and we're all associated with, very large global marketing company. But, do you think that, the bigger businesses generally, both client side and our own side, have the agility to be that sort of innovative and thinking in that way? Or, is there too much structure, too many existing barriers and things of that kind to attract that talent? And if so, do we need more radical approaches in some form?
Well, here's the greatest inhibitor to this going well, and it's money. In order to do this in the right way, it requires an investment. So again, it's not just an opportunity. You've been under indexing in certain markets, and now you want to index or over index on them. You want to seize that opportunity. Well, it shouldn't come to you inexpensively. There needs to be an investment. And that means that the appropriate move into these markets isn't just a chance to have the same growth and profit opportunity that you've had. Doing it right is actually going to be a little less profitable than some of your mainstream brand opportunities in the short term, because you need to find the right way to do this. There needs to be investment. And I have seen already that there can be a great reluctance to actually make the necessary investment. So I think that's one of the big inhibitors. But there's many others, and most of them are related to money too. Having the right diverse teams in-house requires different forms of recruiting than you've done before, ways to reach these individuals. We're both a pro bono agency and a partner of Historically Black College and University Week, which is a giant recruiting fair that lasts a whole week to recruit people into historically black colleges and universities. And that's an investment. You know, we do all that work pro bono. And yet we needed to find multiple new ways to be exposed to people of color and to say, we really want you to come to work here. So it takes an investment. And I do worry about the inertia in companies that won't get them quite to where they need to be to invest.
Yeah, very much so. Rob, also, actually, one of the things you said right at the top there was this issue about short-termism, which we see, you know, as the great barrier to so many good developments in business around sustainability agenda, is that everybody's looking to short-termism, partly because of the tenure of the individuals making those decisions. I mean, I don't know if there's any way around that, really, except that obviously some people, often it's the CEOs and the senior management that spend less time in a business than actually the rest of the employees. And I wonder to what extent you might see how significant existing employee bases are in embracing this agenda and then perhaps holding the management to account, as opposed to the management being the people taking the lead.
You know, I absolutely think the biggest development on this was Larry Fink's series of letters over the past 5 years demanding that companies stop being just short-term and look more long-term over a 5, 10, 15, 20-year horizon. That's why, you know, it sounds kind of like a boring term, ESG, but environmental social governance is now a mandate to take a long-term view. Stop just running your company around quarterly results. Yes, I do think the biggest problems in the world all require a long-term approach. And long-term isn't something that politicians want to do because they're elected to 2 or 4 or 6 years. It's not something that CFOs want to do because they're rewarded around, price-to-earnings ratios and quarterly results. And as you say, the C-suite often, you know, we all kind of joke about CMOs. The average tenure is like 3 years. Brand managers like to cycle in and out of a brand every 2 years. And so you just built the system and incentives around short-term quick fixes and exciting short-term campaigns when all of the big problems that we need to solve require a much longer-term approach. You think about healthcare, you think about economic inequality, gender inequality, racial injustice. They all require a longer-term view. But I do think this push from the top that requires companies now to have rigorous programming around all this is a great ally for those of us who've been trying to make this happen, as you have, John, for a very long time.
Well, thank you, Robin. Yeah, that's great insight, actually. And I do agree. Larry Fink's letters, when they started coming out, were so important, actually, because not necessarily because he was saying anything radically new, but it was the fact that he was saying it. And that's the distinction, because, you know, certain people have been saying it for decades, but it didn't matter because they weren't running trillion-dollar funds. You know, and I think this is a critical thing, isn't it?
I thought that the first year it came out 5 years ago, that it was a one-time thing. And I think the impressive thing is that he is holding companies to the feet to the fire, and he's repeated it every year in his annual letter in one form or another.
Yes, that's a very good point, actually. Yeah, no, it is the fact that he builds on it each year and continues to express the growth of that sentiment and apply that through the investments that are being made. I mean, there are two. I know we're going to come to a refresh very quickly, and we will do that. But I guess there's just one thing I'd like to just finish before I hand over the baton, which is you head up a global operation, and just wonder to what extent do you see cultural differences in this across the globe? I mean, is that are certain territories, I'm not necessarily naming or whatever, but to what extent do localized cultural backgrounds and circumstances affect the embracing of these sorts of agendas? Is that a factor, particularly with the
multinationals? Yes, it is very much a factor. The things our clients have really wrestled with is, you know, speaking out on social issues. Why didn't you speak out about the Uyghurs in China? Why didn't you speak out about the conflict between India and Pakistan? You know, you spoke out about the murder of George Floyd. So why don't you do the same thing in our country? So there can be significant cultural differences. Sometimes when you speak out on behalf of a brand, it can look very different in an authoritarian country, a communist country. And so we've had to develop diagnostics and tools to use to determine when does the global CEO speak out on an issue? When does only a regional level CEO or a local person speak out on an issue? Because there, it is a minefield to assume that they, you know, kind of the conventional wisdom and the view that you want to take in the UK or the United States is going to travel well. And it doesn't always work that way, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we're often very good at creating universal brands and, you know, obviously the lateral around all of that, but the messaging sensitivities around cultural behaviors is very different. I mean, I remember some years ago when the UK decided to bring in anti-corruption legislation and anti-bribery legislation, that was excellent in terms of a UK perspective. Caused major issues in very basic things when major ship owning companies were trying to get people to guide their ships into ports in Pakistan and India, whatever, where the tradition had always been to give the pilots cases full of cigarettes and stuff, which actually was classified by the UK government as a bribe. And, right. You know, that little things like that, which is not actually about campaigning, but it's the way in which, you know, from our own position, and particularly around law and what may be seen as perfectly acceptable behavior in parts of the world, actually doesn't translate into the practicalities of business elsewhere. And there's some real challenges, obviously much more serious than the boxes of cigarettes. But nevertheless, it illustrates, you know, that dichotomy with international sort of initiatives or companies and legislation and social sort of expectations. I'm going to suggest that we do a room refresh now, so, and then hand over the baton to David. So, James, are we ready for a refresh?
We are indeed. Thank you, John. So, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are tuned in around the world, whether you're in New York, where it's 11, London, where it's 4, or Hong Kong, where it's also 11, but the other 11. 2300 hours, I believe, is the appropriate way of saying it. We'll keep it military style to keep John happy. Wherever you are, thank you for tuning in. We very much appreciate it. Welcome to this special edition of the Winners Club Managing Brand Reputation. We are doing a fireside conversation with the one and only Rob Flaherty, the chairman of Ketchum. When big brands want to know the direction that they're going to move forwards with their branding, marketing, communications, PR, etc., Rob is a guy that they call. So we're very honoured and privileged to have his time. If you'd like to ask a question, by the way, please feel free to click on Ashley's face or my face or Paul's face. And on there, you can go to the link in our bio. And on that link in the bio, you will go to a landing page and there is a ask a question button. Hit the ask a question button. And when we open it up shortly to Q&A, you can do exactly that. But this is brought to you by the Winners Club. If you've not yet done so, click the little green house, the little Monopoly house, and we'll hand back over to David.
Hey, thanks, James. And thanks, John, for getting us off to such a deep and insightful series of questions, which I knew Rob would handle adroitly. And James, you're absolutely right. Rob is the guy that gets the call. I've been in the room with him at least a dozen times when he's gotten calls from really impressive, important people on pretty important questions. And I want to continue the thread that we started before the break. I know some of you, at least, won't really know Rob the way I certainly do, and the way I think John's gotten to know him over the last few years. You know, you hear him speak with such authority and experience, and I assure you that's hard won, hard earned from the front line. But of course, Rob, you weren't just born smart. You weren't just born at the top of the heap. So I wonder for people who don't know your trajectory, if you could just maybe talk a little bit, maybe not your whole CV, but kind of, you know, what the overall trajectory of your career was, how you got started, some of your major breaks, and maybe a lesson or two you learned along the way. So I think it's helpful for people to get a little context on your perspective by hearing a little bit about your history. And I hope that's not too out of bounds.
No, it's fine. I'll do the very short version, though. So I was very interested in journalism, as so many people were, you know, coming out of the Watergate era and all of that. And so I went to journalism school, but also got a degree in public relations, which was very rare back then. Very few schools offered it. And that gave me a grounding in what this field is supposed to be. A lot of people in the PR field, communications field, about half studied the field and the other half got into it through journalism or through some other side door. And it does help to have a perspective on what this field is supposed to be. I believe it's supposed to be a mediator between companies and brands and the public. It's not just shilling for them, spinning for them, promoting for them. It's standing in the middle. And I sometimes wish that the firm, instead of PR meaning public relations, meant public responsibility. What is the responsibility of a brand to the stakeholders of the brand or the stakeholders of a company? If we thought of it that way, I think we would have been out ahead of some of what we've been talking about. I just recently wrote a blog post about, boy, on a good day, our field, and this extends to marketing, public relations, corporate reputation, brand reputation, why wouldn't we have been the ones that were out ahead of the need for diversity, equity, and inclusion? And so throughout my career, I have always kind of tried to get our field back to its original and best definition. So I did work in-house at a client, a beverage company for 4 years, then 5 years at a firm called Burson Marsteller, a public relations agency. Came to Ketchum as the associate director of the New York office, was the director of the New York office, which is our largest office at the time for 7 years. But then I had a really good, I think, shift in my career. I ran the global IBM business for many years, along with my good friend, Esti Bujadas, and also got heavily involved running our global corporate practice, which pulled me into the kind of counseling that we're discussing now. What does a company need to do? Both it was crisis management, but it was also corporate reputation, executive visibility, new CEO transitions, and now sustainability and ESG. But then I think I became global president of the company for 4 years, CEO for six, and I've been chairman for 3 years. So that's 13 years. And I found that my ability to counsel clients was really enriched by the business experience. So many people on this session are entrepreneurs. And I think running a company is a great layer onto the experience that you're providing in terms of the advice to your clients, because you have to have looked at it through the lens of the investor, communities, employees, and customers. And that more holistic view really enriched, and it made it more fun for me to counsel companies, because I wasn't looking at it just as a communications counselor. I was looking at it through the lens of being a CEO. So, David, that's kind of the short version of some of how I got here.
Yeah, and it tracks well with my memories, too. I was just thinking about us sitting in that cramped conference room in New York, I think on 6th Avenue, and talking about some of the previous week's events and who the winners and losers were. And I don't want to ask you about winners and losers, but I do want to bring us back into talking about virtue signaling. Which honestly is a phrase I always have a little bit of trouble with. It feels a lot judgmental to me, and I'm kind of concerned about it. But that's just me being pedantic. Maybe if you would just define what you see as virtue signaling, and then if you can maybe just tell us who you think recently has either done a good job of signaling what's going on inside their business and how they want to be perceived in the wider world, and maybe somebody who's done a clumsy job, if you're comfortable.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's for, you know, the other word is performative, that you're just doing this to perform. I think virtue signaling is an important litmus test of what a brand or a company is doing. I think it's useful because are you genuinely trying to do something to help a community, people of color or LGBTQ+, are you doing something that is very real, or are you just kind of trying to be in the mix and say, we feel strongly about these things? I mean, I know a major retailer, I'm not going to name a lot of names here, but I know a major retailer that was very vocal during the Black Lives Matter movement last summer, and said all the right things, but then their stores wanted to sell Black Lives Matter merchandise. You know, you can buy a hat, you can buy a t-shirt, you know, that kind of thing. And they said, no, we don't want to sell that. They privately, they said, we don't want to sell that because it might offend some of our customers. So that's kind of a conflict to me. There's a lack of authenticity in that decision. We're going to say we believe in all of this, but we're going to pull back on something kind of real. And I think the brands have to be, last week I shared that spectrum from, you know, where are you on the spectrum, left to right? Are you at acceptance? Are you an ally? Are you an advocate? Or are you an activist, all the way to being an activist, where you're using your financial leverage and your voice to make a difference, not just to speak out, but to use your financial clout to make a difference on big matters, let's say voting rights legislation. I have four new A's for you this week. and this isn't a spectrum, but it is four things to think about if you're a brand thinking about either doing something or saying something in justice issues or racial justice issues. The first one is audience. What audiences are you thinking about when you do this? I would say be careful that you're not just immediately going to your progressive customer base, if you happen to have a progressive customer base. Most companies have both conservative and liberal customer base, right? Don't just say something because the only audience you're thinking of is your employees. Let's say something because our employees, particularly our chief diversity officer, are asking us to say something. You have to take a comprehensive audience view. Another A word is authentic or authenticity. Is what you're about to say backed by the way you actually are culturally as a company? Or is it out ahead of where you are? So is it authentic? Another A is action. Are you willing to back it with action? Because what we're seeing more and more is if you're going to speak out about something, you're going to be asked, yeah, what did you do about it? What did you do inside your company? What are you doing in the marketing of it? Things like, let's say, hiring minority-owned agencies. And then the fourth A is accountability. Are you willing to be evaluated in your longer-term track record on that subject? In other words, don't just do something performative because you have a great brand opportunity to sell into a target market in which you've been under-indexing, and you go after that, you go after it for 3 months. What about a year from now? Are you going to have stuck with it? Are you going to be able to be accountable through your action? So audience, authenticity, action, and accountability are my four A's this week.
Well, you know, I love a little alliteration. And by the way, the four A's from last week, I tweeted about it, I think, right after the show, and it got a lot of traffic, positive traffic. We need to put that into some sort of graphic, and then we can have a whole series maybe of different A's to remember. But that certainly resonates. And I was going to ask if you had sort of a rule of thumb or heuristic when CEOs or boards ask for when to get engaged. But I think maybe that's at least a big part of the answer is to go through that process. Is there any other sort of short piece of advice you would give in these situations?
Yeah, you know, since virtually all CEOs are now keenly aware of the requirement to speak out on issues, we have developed many tools. I've mentioned two of them, but another one is a quadrant analysis in which there are vectors around, are you really talking about speaking out on social issues, or are you talking about desiring to achieve thought leadership? Because thought leadership would tend to be more around the grand challenges facing the world today. It could be climate change. It could be ethical use of technology. It could be poverty. It could be healthcare, access to healthcare. Those are the grand challenges. And to speak out on those issues is a lower level of controversy. But I would want to make sure that inside the company, there's clarity. Are you mixing them up? Are you kind of just mixing the issues? So you know, gun rights, same-sex marriage. These are more polarizing issues, social issues, et cetera. And so what we do is we help our clients to kind of inventory all of the areas they could be commenting. And then to have clarity, if you're being authentic, are you hewing more toward thought leadership topics, or do you really want to wade into more controversial social topics? But it's almost created a whole new consulting art, a series of tools that help companies really think through in advance where they are. Sometimes we call it the oxymoron, planned spontaneity. You know, You do not have to sit around kind of a little bit panic-stricken when some big event happens, constantly at the executive committee level saying, we have to say something. We're getting tons of requests to say something. What do we say? And start from square one. We've now developed many ways to inventory the possible issues, to actually draft our position statement in advance across a dozen issues, and then tailor it to the incident when it happens. And actually have kind of a, this kind of formula for how to comment on these things. First, a reaction to the event. We were shocked and saddened to see. Then a statement of your values at our organization we believe very strongly in. Then think about whether you need to take a position and take some action. You don't have to, but you need to be thinking about that. It's not enough now just to speak. You have to be thinking, what action should we take? So we've had to develop a lot of tools to help clients to anticipate and then do this kind of planned spontaneity in which they already have a well-thought-out point of view that they are then just tailoring to the spontaneous moment when it's needed. But that's helped.
Yeah, I can see that. And I have put many of your tools to work over the years. I think maybe John and I might go one step further and say that if you've got a clear sense of business purpose built around real human truth, it makes it even easier to make those decisions about what's really salient, what's a little bit salient, and maybe what's not something to focus on. I can follow up all day, but we've got such a great set of guests on stage, and I know another great set of questions lining up in the audience. I can see a long line of questions lining up, so I don't want to get in the way. Two are anonymous, so I hope I can ask them if that's all right. And one was it touches on a theme that we covered last week, but I know we've got some new listeners, and it goes back to the pandemic. Obviously disruptive, but is it, and these are my words, but is it permanently disruptive? Will brands and companies find themselves talking about themselves, marketing themselves in completely different ways forever, or will it be a temporary change or maybe no change at all? What's your thought on the pandemic's impact on marketing and communications?
I think there will be a lot of permanent change. Not everything is changing. A lot of things will be done similarly, but the way people access goods and services has been changed forever. And there's been more done for digital transformation in the last 15 months than in the 15 years before that. And so I think there will be many permanent changes to it. And many of them will be very good. As we come out of the darkness of the pandemic, there are a lot of really positive things that are going to come out of it too. And, remote and more flexible ways of working. But that is going to be a pendulum, right? There's going to be a lot of clumsy attempts to, you've got a generation of people now who don't think they need to go back to the office, and you're going to have some bosses that think they do. And so it's going to be kind of a little messy. You have, from the leader of Salesforce, Mark Benioff, to many of the tech companies saying people don't have to come back to the office at all. But then you have Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, saying people are coming back to the office. He said last week that he knows of circumstances in which they lost big pieces of business recently because other banks got on a plane and went and visited the client, and they were still in kind of a no travel mode. So he's coming out, if you could name a more influential CEO right now than Jamie, I'm all ears, but he is incredibly influential. What he says often kind of leads others, and he is saying, get back into the office. So it's going to be interesting how many things remain permanent. I think there are going to be many, and I think many of them are good, but some will go back to the way it was.
Hello and welcome. This is a very special edition of The Winners Club. We have got a fireside conversation with Rob Flaherty, the chairman of Ketchum, one of the most knowledgeable guys on the planet about brand marketing and overall communication. So there's not many opportunities where you'd get the chance to ask a question to a guy like Rob. Please, by the way, guys, Rob is at the top left-hand side with the green bean just underneath his face. Go and give him a follow. He's one of the most knowledgeable guys in the world about branding and marketing. He's only got 225 followers. Come on, guys. Let's get a few more followers for Rob. And this is session two of a four-room series that we're going to be running all about managing brand reputation. So we've had some Q&As. We've had loads of Q&A, actually. So we're going to open it up now to the people who've asked a question. By the way, guys, if you have just tuned in and you would like to speak to Rob or ask Rob a question, you can click on either my face or Ashley's face or Paul's face as well. And you can, click onto our link in our bio and go and hit the ask a question button. That's where you can ask your questions. But in the meantime, we've already had some through. So Alana, would you like to unmute yourself? You had a question about values-led consumption.
Hi, thank you. You did kind of answer that when you were talking just a moment ago, but I will extend on that if you don't mind. Rob, thank you for the incredible conversation. But I'm curious if you think that there will also be great marketing opportunities there. One of the big principles of sustainability is think global, act local. And I wonder if we'll see, I'd just like your thoughts on, if you think we'll see a return to sort of more localised marketing strategies and more sort of niche engagement, and even what your thoughts are on 3D printing within that space. So I'm Alana, I'm done speaking. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for the question, Alana. I do think there is a very big role for local, because in order for something to be real, it has to have an impact at the community level. You mentioned street fashion. You can't just wish that your mainstream white brand is adopted by, let's say, the hip-hop community, and wow, we're going to double our sales. You have to have done something to give your brand away and have it be adopted and changed, influenced by that community, owned by them. And by the way, owned by them in a very real sense. Give them a stake in the new venture, financial stake. So it has to be real and local in order for that to happen.
Right, we've got some more questions. In fact, we've got loads and loads of questions. We'll get through as many as possible because I know that we've got Rob until about 5:30 UK time. So we've got about another 28 minutes or so. So we'll try and crack on with as many as we can get through. Michelle, I'm not sure if Michelle is still in the room. Michelle, are you here? If you are, flash your mic or say hello. She might have popped out. But she had a great question. So I'll ask it on her behalf then. So Michelle asked, how do we increase pressure from the purchaser, e.g. educating our children on the impact of fast fashion? Should these companies be made to educate their customers? And that's from Michelle.
Yeah, interesting. I think there is a huge role for brands to play in education of all forms, right? We no longer can just look to governments to have an impact on some of these issues that we face. We need corporations and brands to step up. And I think there is a huge role for brands to play in education. And that goes to all forms, your health and wellness. I think brands are going to be playing a bigger role in mental health, for example, in the future, as we destigmatize mental health issues. So I think there's now more of a, not just an opportunity, but a responsibility for brands to play a role in taking care of their customers, not just taking advantage of their customers.
Great answer. Thank you, Rob. We've got a few more people. We're going to be bringing them up to stage as well. Ian Gertler says, Rob.
Hey, James.
Are you? Yes, who's this?
This is Jeff. I submitted a question. I have another room I have to go to. I was just wondering if I could ask because I've been.
Are you trying to queue jump, Jeff?
Am I trying to queue jump? Me, never.
Go on, mate. It's a good question. I can see. Is it about B Corps?
It is. B Corps.
Go for it, mate. Ask away.
Thank you so much, Rob. I really enjoyed listening to the conversation. The moderators have been asking amazing questions, and your insight has been just profound. So thank you for that. I've been talking to a number of people about B Corps recently, and I know Etsy was a B Corp, and then you know they're public company, and then now they're no longer a B Corp. And I'm just curious because with everything that we're talking about in this room, I just thought it was timely to ask, you know, what are your thoughts on B Corps, and is it possible right now to have a public company and also be a B Corp, and how does that future look like? What, you know, considering all the things we're talking about, I think B Corps are an important part. So I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree, but I look forward to the day when all corps are B corps. you know, if a B Corp is for those, you know, they meet the highest standards of social, environmental, public transparency, balancing profit and purpose, right? And isn't that, that when I talk about with David about writing a book, The Future of the Corporation, that's kind of what I'm talking about. You know, I don't want the just some corporations to figure out a way to be a B Corp. I want that smaller subset to become the mainstream. And I think that's what we kind of have to do. We have to get all corporations to the point where they're living the life of a B Corp. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. It just worries me, though, that, like, you know, companies like Etsy, which were B Corps and were public, are no longer B Corps. And I'm just wondering how we can kind of buck that trend and keep just make more B Corps. And because, as you know, it's actually the process for doing it. It's kind of like an accreditation. It's not really that you're incorporating as a different type of corporation, as far as my understanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're getting there. And I think we have to help many more corporations to get there.
Awesome. Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate it. Good queue jump. I respect a good queue jump. Us over here, us Brits, we love queuing for stuff, but I love a queue jumper. So good on you, my friend. Right, we've got loads of questions and queries coming up. So let me go on to the next one. We had Jeff. We had Lana. We've got Zoe. Zoe didn't have a question, but she just wanted to give a bit of a shout out, I think. She said, I worked at Ketchum London, leading the digital direction of the agency, and part of their success is down to the excellent leadership and their openness and honesty. So, there you go. There's nothing, no question there. Just wanted to doff your cap, guys, who are involved in that. That's nice to hear from Zoe. Is Zoe still here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, hello, Zoe.
Hello.
You speak highly of Rob and the gang.
Well, yes, and it's really funny because I was also at Manning Gottlieb, I worked at Manning Gottlieb, which is Omnicom, and then moved to Ketchum, London, as digital director. And Rob probably knows Joanne very well, but she is an amazing leader for the agency and the direction. Yeah.
Great. Good to hear from you, Zoe. Thank you.
Pleasure. Awesome stuff. Thank you very much. Guys, if you've got any, I think if you don't mind, because I know that David's obviously got a load of more questions that he can chuck in Rob's direction as well. But if Modern Speak is on the panel, if you've got any questions you'd like to flash your mic and ask, we can open up to a few of those as well, because I know we've got loads of people who've maybe have just jumped in. Stacey, we'll come to you next, my friend.
Oh, fantastic. How is everyone?
Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Rob. Rob, I just, I, you and I met at PRSA San Francisco. This is around 2014, and you spoke about the future of the PR agency. Don't quote me on the year, but I think it was 2014. It was, again, it was in San Francisco. Okay. And actually, I dug up a quote that you said during your presentation that I just wanted to share. And I just wanted you to comment on, you know, did, you know, are we there? And, you know, just a little talk about earned media. So you spoke a lot about that PR has a bright future as career, but new skill sets are required. And your quote is, anything that is not paid should be our sweet spot. It is incumbent on us to retake our claim in this territory, large opportunity, and show we have the skill set, always had to gain the presence of our message. Let's use that skill and use the ability to interpret what others want and put it into practice in a broader lens. So I just wanted to see if, you know, if you have any thoughts about, this is going back about 7 years ago, from and by the way, you're brilliant in, you know, in everything future of PR, because I feel like everything that you said came true. So thank you, and it's great to see you again, at least virtually. And I'm Stacey, and I'm done.
Great. Thanks, Stacey, for the comments. What I was saying was new skills will be needed, and part of it is this left brain, right brain. Our field was more art than science for a very long time. Now it needs to be a lot more science. And I've said I want data scientists to be the hottest job at Ketchum. We have now hired a lot of data scientists because what we're merging is the earned play in communications with the ability to do what's called attribution, to use technology and the ability to track the customer journey and show how earned communications had an impact on their decision to buy a product or service. And that requires a lot of cookies and being able to see what people are linking to, who they're sharing content with. So a lot of that is happening. We have a dramatically changed employee workforce at Ketchum now with a lot more emphasis on data and technology. We have a new service called Omni Earned ID, which uses a combination of databases to really ID, track individuals as they interact with content and then make decisions about purchases, this attribution. But I was also saying that we can't go too heavily into the paid side. We now use paid amplification because you have to get things to fly on the social web. But we are still aiming for the unpaid side of the house. I love to remind people that the most valuable media in the world is the only kind you can't buy. Most valuable media in the world is the only kind you can't buy. And by can't buy, think of influencers. There are influencers that you pay all the time, and there are influencers you never pay. The ones you never pay can have more credibility than the ones that you pay, right? So whether we're going for articles in a publication or shared content, the stuff that flies that isn't paid is going to have more credibility. I like the new definition of news is something important enough to find me. It used to be news was a destination. I sought out a magazine. I sought out a evening news program. No one seeks out news anymore. News finds you. And more often than not, it's because a friend recommended something to you or retweeted it to you or posted it on Instagram. And so this idea of getting into the shared story is more powerful than the push story. The demand side of news is more important than the supply side of news. And that's some of what I was talking about back then in San Francisco. And a lot of that is happening now. And we've had to fundamentally transform our industry, let alone our agency, in order to do that. So I'm so happy that you remembered that and really appreciate the comment and question.
And thank you. I couldn't agree with you more. Earned media is priceless. And I love all the technology and innovation that you're doing, because if you think about it, you know, the new competitive advantage is truly innovation. And thank you, Rob.
Sure. Thank you, Stacey.
Awesome stuff. Thank you, Stacey. Very much appreciated. So we had Rosalind. Rosalind said, Rob stated earlier that he sees brands taking a role in mental health. Please expand on how he sees this pivot occurring, if possible. So that's Rosalind's question for you, Rob.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important things that's coming out of the pandemic is much more openness about mental health. And it's long overdue. You know, there was, I think, good progress over the last decade. But I have been working with some big companies, and they're taking it a step further, mostly inside the company, but also outside. One, I won't name names, but one is a big Canadian company, national Canadian company, and their CEO felt that mental health was something that needed to be destigmatized. He shared his own story, but he also took a significant chunk of their advertising budget that they would be spending advertising their services as a financial services company and their celebrity spokespeople and had them speak out about mental health, including online sites to go to, toll-free numbers to call if you need help with your mental health, and did something that is still quite rare, an employee resource group for people with mental health issues. Now, you talk about, and another one that I thought was enlightened was a support structure for, first off, permission to take time off for mental health, including, serious time off, like 6 months if needed, and a way to re-enter the workplace that is not stigmatized, you know, where you have to say, I was out for a week because I had an appendicitis, you know, when it in fact was a significant kind of mental health crisis. Nobody ever comes back and says, I had a significant mental health crisis, you know, it's too stigmatized. And so I think we're going to see brands and corporations use their empathy and their belief that it's not enough to have a few public service announcements about this. Brands and companies have to start showing leadership and destigmatizing mental health, making it something we openly talk about. And I think leaders need to do that too. So I could talk about that forever because I feel very strongly about it. It's such a shame for me to know that there are thousands of young people who never heard enough about mental health, and they think it's only happening to them. And we, as those of us on this in this room that are older, have an obligation to tell our stories and destigmatize it and get people to feel much more comfortable with what they're going through. So thank you for bringing that up.
Great answer. Thank you, Rob. We'll hand back over now to David to if there's any final thoughts that have come to him or final tricky questions he can chuck in your direction. David, I'm going to hand it back to you, my friend.
Hey, thanks, James. Thank you, James and Paul, for setting up the room, inviting not just me and John, but people like Rob that we happen to have been privileged to get to know over the years. I think it's a great service to the community, and I don't think people necessarily know, because you make it look so easy, how hard you work to set these things up, keep things moving, make sure that people are getting a good shot at getting their questions answered. Hopefully, if they didn't get their questions answered, they'll come back next week and try again, because I know the queue was quite long. So thank you, you guys, and I'm sorry I didn't say that last week. And I do want to once again thank Rob. And rather than try to summarize the whole afternoon, because we covered a lot of ground, I just want to pick up on one point that I thought really got my attention, because I think it's true, and it's something that Rob tried to teach me over the years. I think I learned it, but it's the importance of people who have had some experience in the business. You might call us older people. It's the importance of us giving back, of us having some sense of obligation to share what we've learned, and not just the good stuff, but the hard stuff, the painful stuff, the mistakes. And nobody that I know of has given more back to the community, to the industry, than Rob has with his leadership in different organizations, his willingness to come on to conversations like this. It's who he is as a person, and I think you can see his reflection throughout the rest of Ketchum. And I was really gratified to hear Zoe's remarks earlier, because I think leadership starts at the top and works its way through. So thank you, Rob. I just wanted to echo that point, and hopefully everyone heard it, and if they missed it, maybe they'll go back and reflect on it. So that's really it for me. No more hard questions, no more surprise pitches for books. But I wonder if you had anything that you wanted to say that I didn't direct the question to you well enough. Is there any kind of closing comments you wanted to make?
Well, what I would say is I mentioned last week that I love that Clubhouse is diverse and multi-generational. And while we've said those of us who have a lot of experience in the field need to give back and discuss what we did well and didn't do well, and I'm very willing to do that, I also have a very high level of respect for people who are 25 and 35 years old in this industry. One of the things that I find to be a bit of a conundrum, I've been asked to consider being a university professor as I head toward moving away from full-time work. And I say, well, I would be very interested in teaching maybe a course in leadership or leadership communication at the graduate level, but I shouldn't be teaching undergraduate courses in this field. The world needs a lot of 35-year-old professors right now. And by that, I mean digital natives who are very adept naturally, innately at the social technologies that are the centerpiece of this business now. And, you know, we need people who, it's kind of a weird world. Academia is kind of weird, right? You have a bunch of 60-year-olds teaching a bunch of 20-year-olds. And there is a role for that. you know, teach strategy, teach perspective, teach industry depth. But in an ever-changing field, there's also a very huge role for people with 10 years of experience, not 40. And so I love that Clubhouse enables us all to get together and hear from people of all ages. And I want to continually encourage that, you know, not just your questions, but also your comments about what you see. Because, you know, I happen to think the millennial generation, not to generalize too much, but has an awesome set of values. And business and brands need more of what they're roaring about. And so I just want to thank the, you know, the generation that's taking over the world right now for the values that you bring and encourage more of it.
This has been a very special room brought to you by the Winners Club in conversation fireside style with the managing, with the current chairman of Ketchum, Rob Flaherty. This conversation has been all around managing brand reputation. This is room number two of a four-room series with Rob, one of the most knowledgeable guys on the planet about marketing, brands and communication. So make sure you tune in again next week. Please feel free to click onto the Monopoly House, the little greenhouse at the top of the room, and that's where you can find out more great stuff that's coming from the Winners Club. We've got various rooms running throughout the mornings, the afternoons, the evenings, all throughout the week here on Clubhouse, bringing you the very best content from around the world, the best speakers, the best insights and wisdom. Thank you guys for being here, and enjoy the rest of your day, your afternoon, your morning, your evening, wherever you are around the world. Cheers, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.